This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
G'day, Diplomates fans. Something slightly different on this occasion, a little bit of bonus content, if you will. I recently appeared on a panel session with Senator Christina Keneally. We discussed a number of issues, Senator Keneally in her role as opposition spokesperson for Home Affairs, discussed sort of Labor's approach and the Australian challenge in addressing migration in a post-COVID era. Of course, now we have a lot of hard borders in place in Australia and around the world. And I appeared in my capacity as Assistant National Secretary at ABU, talking about trade policy and what COVID means in terms of sovereign capability, trading between nations, and what Australia should be doing to safeguard its domestic and international supply chains. It's a little bit of a different chat. A lot of people have asked me whether or not I can get the Senator on. This is the best I've managed in this occasion, though, I'll keep reaching out to the Senator. We'll try to make it a time to get KK on the show. So look, it's a bit different. I hope you enjoy it. Feel free to listen. I think you'll learn a lot from what Senator Keneally has to say about the challenges we face in immigration policy. I will also say that at the end, some of the guests in the audience ended up asking me the question, the very lame barbecue question was asked of Senator Keneally and myself. So I did answer that, although I did criticise the person for asking it given the lameness of the question. Anyway, enjoy the episode.
So I'd like to just begin by just asking Senator Keneally how she thinks COVID-19 can change immigration policy in Australia for the foreseeable future.
Mm. Thanks, Brendan. Thanks, everyone, for being here. Thanks, Misha, as well, for joining the conversation. Clearly, COVID-19 is having a massive impact on immigration and migration, and that starts with the fact that the borders are closed. They've been closed now for almost 2 months. They look likely to remain closed for the next 12 months. There may be some small changes in that in certain ways to allow people in safely if it's safe to do so. But if you look at what is happening in the United States, in Indonesia, in India, in China, in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea, in Western Europe, you only need to realize that Australia's relative success in flattening the curve would be undone if we were to reopen the borders to the type of free movement, relatively free movement, of people that we had prior to COVID-19. This stoppage of migration means that at some point over the next 12 months, most likely, and we're not entirely sure when yet, that we will, as a country, do something we have never done before, which is restart a migration program from a standing stop. And that gives us an opportunity right now to be asking what kind of migration program do we want that to be? This is, I believe, an opportunity for the country to take stock of what's been happening in the migration program for the past 2 decades. And for us as a political movement, particularly one that is concerned about not only a progressive future for our country, but also the rights and conditions of working people, of all working people, this is an opportunity for us to argue to reset a migration program in our national interest. And when I say that, I mean in the interest of working people, in the interest of social cohesion, in the interest of economic growth, in the interest of the budget bottom line. Now, let me be clear. We are a country built on migration. You only need to think about the story of Australia particularly since the war, since post-war Australia, where we have seen successive waves of migrants come here from every corner of the earth, settle permanently and build this country, raise their families, build the infrastructure, you know, think of this Snowy Hydro scheme, start small businesses, send their children to school, join their local churches, political parties, community groups, and become part of the fabric of this nation, which makes us the most successful multicultural nation on earth. And, you know, all of us, whether we, no matter how long or short ago our ancestors came here, unless we are first Australians, unless we are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, we are all part of that immigrant story to this country. And, you know, I also acknowledge that Australians, and I celebrate that Australians are enthusiastic welcomers of new migrants, and I myself experienced that in the sense that I came here in 1994 as a permanent resident, as a migrant. And, you know, we know that our nation benefits when people come here and are able to join in, make that contribution and become part of the story of Australia and have a stake in its future. Now, what this COVID-19 stoppage gives us a chance to examine in detail is really a case portfolio. Powerful, unifying idea of a nation built by migration, where people come here, settle down, and become part of the Australian community, is an idea that risks becoming nostalgia rather than our ongoing reality. And that is because since John Howard, we have seen a shift in our migration program away from that pathway to permanency. And successive governments, including Labor governments, but I really have to acknowledge that it's been under Liberal governments that these settings have been ramped up, we have seen the pathways to permanency narrow. We have seen temporary migration expand, and we saw it come to almost its logical and perhaps almost absurd conclusion under Scott Morrison last year, when he said he was capping permanent migration at 160,000 people per year because, you know, this was a congestion busting measure. But yet he has allowed temporary migration to continue uncapped and be demand driven, which means that really the government, through its migration policies, they're not determining who comes to this country and the manner in which they come, to borrow a famous phrase. What we are really seeing is businesses, universities, state governments, and other forms of employers make that decision about who they're going to allow into the country. And we are also seeing an expansion, a real significant expansion of schemes like the Working Holiday Maker Program and the Seasonal Worker Program, and of course, international students and the work rights that they have. Now, all of these things might be useful, and there is a role for temporary migration in certain places and in certain contexts, you know, things like seasonal work, fruit picking, where it is hard sometimes, quite often, to get Australians to take on a seasonal role in a regional area. There might be reasons, say, in cybersecurity, where we need a lot more people qualified in that area than we can train up quickly. And so temporary migration, skilled or unskilled, has a role to play in our economy, and it always will. But we are now, our island home is now home to the second largest the second largest migrant workforce in the world, in the OECD, I apologize, behind the United States. So we're the second largest migrant workforce in the OECD. We are right behind the United States. And one of the largest groups within that is, of course, international students. There are over 600,000 young people from around the globe that come to study in Australia. The majority of those are in New South Wales. And what have we heard over the past few years? Example after example of wage theft and exploitation. And, you know, we should remember that the first serious case of wage theft that really, you know, brought this problem into prominence was 7-Eleven, did involve migrant workers, international students, temporary visa holders. And, you know, what we know from the multiple consultations, reports that have been tabled in Parliament and the like, is that the temporary nature of these workers' visa adds to their vulnerability, makes them vulnerable to exploitation, and creates the conditions whereby employers use that temporary status to drive down wages and to take advantage of the their circumstances. So, and while many of you may not think that this impacts you directly, although I acknowledge there may well be people on this Zoom meeting who are themselves international students, but many of you will be young, you will be students, or you will be have just left training or skills training or university. And, you know, I want to remind you that the treatment of younger workers has an impact on all workers. That is, if we are seeing, and we are seeing, exploitation occur, particularly amongst temporary visa holders, so in quite serious as well, that starts to take hold across the economy and across employment. And so when we have things like wages being undercut, people being told they have to work for cash in hand for below award rates, it is harder for every other young person in particular to get a good, well-paying and secure job when that becomes the economic model. So I would argue that in the name of lower wages and cheap labor, the government is risking a new and damaging form of social and economic exclusion. We only need to look at COVID and the response to that to see how excluded these temporary visa holders are. The government has absolutely refused, and again today in the COVID Senate hearing, as the Minister for Finance, Matthias Cormann, made clear, the government has absolutely no intention to provide any form of support to temporary visa holders who are trapped here during this pandemic. You know, his only argument was, if they can't support themselves through a job, they should go home. Never minding that some of them, their borders will be closed. Some of them can't actually physically get a flight. And some of them and it will be on a path to permanency. Not many, but some will. And that would mean they would actually have to forfeit that path to permanency. So this, my concern has always been that we risk becoming a two-tiered society where we have Australian citizens and permanent residents who are able to access rights, to assert their rights at work, to access services, to access support. And then we have another group of workers, guest workers, temporary migrant workers, who are locked out of those same rights, locked out of those same services, and locked out of having a stake in the future of our country. And when we have a crisis like bushfires, and again with COVID-19, we have seen how temporary migrant holders have been disproportionately impacted. And when we talk about we're all in this together, well, a virus doesn't check your visa status before it infects you. You know, we are not all in this together. If we have, you know, some 1 million workers who live in Australia who are unable to access support and services during this time. You know, no less than Peter Costello said back during his time in office that Australia will never become a guest worker nation. You know, I've got news from Mr. Costello and the Liberals that is precisely what they are turning our country into. And when we, I'll end on this point. I think in this period, while the borders are closed, this is an opportunity for us to look at a range of policy settings, whether it's, you know, whether we have truly independent labor market testing, whether we are truly providing a pathway to skills and training for Australians to be able to work in these jobs. I mean, workers don't just pick fruit. 1 in 5 chefs, 1 in 4 cooks, 1 in 6 hospitality workers, 1 in 10 nursing and personal care support workers hold a temporary visa. Now, if the borders are going to be closed and we are going to have workforce shortages as the domestic economy reopens, this is the time to be saying, how do we skill Australians up? How do we fill those skill shortages? And to look at our skills and training system so that we can provide pathways to employment, to good jobs, secure jobs for Australians. But we should also think about when we reopen that migration, you know, what do we want it to look like? I would argue that we would want it to provide more pathways to permanency, to encourage more higher skilled, younger, workers to come here, settle permanently, establish families. You know, they have the least impact on the budget. They have the greatest contributor to economic growth. They grow jobs and opportunity, and they help us build up again that sense of a holistic society where we all have a contribution, we all have a go, we all get a fair go. So I will end on that point. There's a whole range of other things I could talk about in terms of some of the industrial relations policy settings that would help us drive down exploitation and particularly wage theft. But I will end on that point. I'm mindful there will be questions, and I know that Misha has things to say as well. So I'll stop there, Brandon, but hopefully that gives people a good context in terms of how I'm thinking and we here in Canberra in the federal opposition are thinking about these questions.
Thank you very much, Christina. And I'll pass on to Misha now. So Misha, how will COVID-19 change trade policy in Australia for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think what COVID-19 has done is shown how interconnected the world is. Now, I mean, clearly trade is important, has always been important for Australia and will always be important for Australia. Australia's a trading nation, it's a cliche, but, you know, trade is critical to our standard of living. But there's probably 4 things that I think that are important when you think about the impacts in respect to trade policy and what's happened with COVID-19. The first one, I think, is that it's shown up the danger or how fraught it is for a nation state to be reliant on just-in-time supply chains. So essentially, I mean, you can't run a nation state like it's a local service station. You can't just have things turn up in the morning and be dropped off. It's a far more complex enterprise than that. And so fundamentally, the basic principle of economic sovereignty and the basic expectation of citizens is that a country can produce the things and deliver the things it needs when we need them. You know, the one that everyone's focused on in this instance has been, you know, personal protective equipment, PPE. It just so happens that, when the virus broke out in Wuhan, I mean, Wuhan's essentially the world's, you know, factory. So 90% of face masks are made in Wuhan, which is probably suboptimal when you need, to have masks urgently for everyone around the world when you're dealing with a respiratory illness. I mean, the other issue, and again, it was particular to this supply chain relating to health, but, the number 2 place after Wuhan when it comes to ventilator manufacture is actually Northern Italy. Now, it's kind of peculiar that it happened that way, but it's just very interesting that suddenly you can very quickly find yourself not having the things you need when you need them. I think it's something that it's been a real wake-up call for Australians, and we actually commissioned some polling the other day. We literally asked that question, has COVID-19 been a wake-up call for you as an Australian about Australia's reliance on global supply chains? And 90% of people responded yes to that, either strongly agree or agree. So it's, I think that principle, relying on purely on just supply, just-in-time supply chains, I think is a critical change and one that we'll see us have to make some, some serious decisions about how we're managing our supply chains. I mean, PPE on this occasion, but, with the fuel security, for example, Australia only has 28 days of fuel. Now, the 90 days is what the International Energy Agency mandates to have its storage. We have 28, maybe. In certain types of fuel, it's as low as 18 days. Now, without fuel, you essentially can't feed yourself, you can't transport yourself, you can't defend yourself. And so, again, on this occasion it was health, but on other occasions, there are, and you can talk to experts in this area, but it wouldn't take much to think about the disruption that you would get throughout a fuel supply chain. So very quickly, Australia would be out of fuel and sort of in dire straits, really, is the truth of the matter. And it's something that we need to urgently look at, but there are a whole host of other areas. So, I mean, which kind of brings me to the next point, which is that supply chains are sovereign. And what I mean by that is, look, you know, we talk about them. Economists talk about supply chains in a sort of high-level manner as though they're this kind of thing that exists above nation states. Ultimately, they are still controlled by nation states, not by corporations. And so countries make rational decisions, and they make rational decisions in their own self-interest to fulfill the needs of domestic citizens before they on-sell. Now, you know, that's completely okay. I mean, we would expect the same thing. If there was a international shortage of a particular item and Australia was a prominent exporter of that good, we would expect that our government would say, hang on a minute, we've got to sort out our domestic needs first before we on-sell this. And that's just the nature of things. I mean, nations trade in their self-interest, not doing other nations a favour. It's done, pretty in a kind of either national interest or a economic hard-nosed way. So those two things in combination, I think, again, have made a real wake-up call for how the world actually works, and that globalization is not something that is beyond anyone's control, and that the nation state is still powerful in the way that goods are exchanged internationally. The third point that I would make, it's related to the first and the second, and it's about whether the sticker price is the actual price. So a lot of people, when it comes to trade, will say, well, you know, you just take the lowest price that you can get. To use a wonky term, what we've now seen is that the risk premium adjustment for goods, to put into kind of normal language, is that the real price is the price that you pay when you need it. You know, when shit hits the fan, that's the price. The price isn't when there's lots available. The price of a face mask, you could see what the price people were prepared to pay in the black market for these goods online and in other ways, and the desperation that we found. I mean, toilet paper, right? We laughed about it, but you know, when that level of panic goes through communities, that's the real price for the good. And so, it's about making an assessment of what are the things that we need, when we need them, who supplies them, how can we get them, and what are we prepared to pay for them, and not actually just looking beyond the sticker price to say, no, well, the real price for this good is what we need to have in storage or in production, and we need to have it when we need it. And so those three things in combination, I think, are going to have a profound, profound change in the way that countries trade with one another, the way that Australia trades with the world. And I think that, when you used to have this debate, within the Labor Party or within the broader public discourse, people used to think that it was kind of in the abstract that, it's never going to happen sort of thing. So this national security argument or sovereign capability argument was dismissed as essentially kind of either Fortress Australia type thinking, scaremongering, or essentially rent seeking, trying to, promote domestic industries at the expense of the consumer. Well, it's shown up now. On this occasion, we got relatively lucky. I mean, it was quite scary for a period there, obviously, but I think the nature of the goods and the way that we're able to respond was, worked out okay, but wouldn't always. The fourth point I'd make, and this is the last point, but this is kind of the foundational critical point, it's played out recently in some of our foreign policy, is that it's absolutely critical for Australia that a rules-based trading system is maintained. Australia can't, we are a middle power. We are a rich trading nation. We benefit greatly from a rules-based trading system, where there is a agreed set of rules and those rules are enforced by an independent umpire and everyone observes the rules. But we also don't benefit. Australia can't, hope to exist in a situation or in an economic trading system where might is right. Essentially, if the big dog wins, that's a problem for Australia, given our relative size and given our reliance on trade internationally. So, when we're seeing things like trade being used in the form of foreign policy coercion, as we've seen from the Chinese Communist Party, or when it comes to dumping of goods into Australia, which essentially dumping is selling goods into another country with the express aim of destroying that market, so that way you can continue to sell, right? You know, those two things are not in our interests. And when you look at the question of barley, when it comes to the tariffs that have been placed onto barley by the Chinese Communist Party of 80%, they're just not based in any sort of reality. Australia places zero tariffs on our barley. It is the most world's most competitive barley producers that come from Australia. We have zero tariffs on it. You know, China and other nations, frankly, are notorious subsidizers of the agricultural sector. So when you look at that argument, you can see what it is. It's Australia being punished for its foreign policy decisions. On this occasion, the decision to call for an independent inquiry into COVID-19 and the origin. But there are also other decisions that Australia's made that have been threatened, be it 5G network with Huawei and other things of that nature. So not having an independent umpire in place is a very, very dangerous place for Australia to be. And so we absolutely need to preserve a rules-based trading order, because it's good for Australia as a trading nation, and it's good for Australia as a middle power to have a well-supported multilateral global system, not just for trade, but for all things. So, you know, I think trade's absolutely critical for Australia, but we need to be a little more clear-eyed about exactly what it is that we want our country to be, what are the things that we need it to have, what are the expectations of the things that we need to have at the pivotal moments, and as the world becomes more uncertain, that we are sovereignly capable in critical industries and in the things that we rightly expect to have when we need them. So I'm happy to take questions, but I think that probably gives a snapshot of where I think it's heading. It's heading into an area where I think Australia can actually leverage it to our advantage. We've got everything we need in Australia to produce much more than we currently do. Currently, we trade a lot of primary produce, which is good in terms of mining and agricultural things, but we can definitely make a lot more finished product. We've got everything we need, from energy to raw materials to the people, apart from the vision. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. We can certainly use this, you know, this time to retool our manufacturing sector, and in the process, create lots and lots of jobs for average Aussies looking to work in regional communities. So I'll leave it there, but happy to take questions, Brendan. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Misha. So we're now going to move on to answering some questions that were submitted on the Google form. So just to Senator Keneally, how long should Australia's international borders be closed during the pandemic, even after the numbers are heavily reduced, if not eradicated by this year?
Look, that is a question that's going to be determined by what's happening in the rest of the world and safe for us to do. Yeah, we might want to open up borders for, say, a particular skill need. I mentioned cybersecurity earlier. Today, the ASIO Director General made clear that we are at even greater risk of cybersecurity attacks, of online, you know, manipulation, foreign interference, and it may be that we need to bring in more people in that particular skill set, with that particular skill set. And so, you know, do we do that with, you know, the 2-week quarantine? Who pays for it? Same thing with international students. You know, there may come a time where we feel comfortable, or, you know, we have a desire to facilitate the reentry of international students to universities. But again, you know, how do you do it? How is it safely done? Who pays for it? Is that attractive to people? So, and there may be the opportunity for somewhere like New Zealand, where you've got people talk about this trans-Tasman bubble. That may be a possibility. But, you know, I think the question about how long our borders stay closed is really going to be determined by what's going on in the rest of the world. It still remains the case that we have not had this, you know, we have had community transmission, but you know, a significant amount, I believe I'd go need to go back and double check, but I believe it is still the majority of our cases did come from an overseas. So we are trying to make sure that does not spike again with the second wave.
Well, thank you very much. And so just to Misha, so what can the ALP do to support regional jobs in the rice industry and improve Australian trade in the face of China extorting countries that Australia used to export rice to?
Thank you for that question. It's a very esoteric question. I should just flag that I'm not an agricultural economist, but I'll do my best to answer the question. Look, I mean, I think going back to my comments about barley, look, Australia is an extraordinarily competitive agricultural economy. Our farmers are the world's most competitive, and we export to the world, all sorts of produce, right? In terms of rice, I think there'll be some ongoing challenges for Australia in making sure that our farmers are able to access the water that they need, and we'll need to continue to be very innovative in our use of water for water-hungry crops like rice or cotton. But, certainly the expectation would be that in a rules-based order, so going back to my comments about rules-based trading system, if nobody is subsidising rice, then Australia should be essentially the world's rice bowl. To the extent that we can produce it, the world should be able to buy it. Now, from memory, and I'm just going off the top of my head, but China subsidizes agricultural sector quite significantly. I was looking at this recently. I'm pretty sure it's about to the, might have these numbers wrong. So, for those listening on the tape and Googling, wanting to hang me on this, I'm pretty sure it's about 25% that they subsidise their rice industry to that extent. So, again, if you don't have an umpire in place to say, well, hang on a minute, you can't subsidise your goods here and then use that subsidy to take market share off not just Australia but other countries that are producing rice, or you use that 25% advantage to dump into another good. So, for example, let's just say we had a situation where Chinese rice was subsidised and then it was dumped into Australia below cost with that subsidy. So therefore, the domestic industry can't compete and has to close down. And suddenly, what was a completely competitive industry is now being closed through basically illegal cheating. I mean, it's effectively, I mean, when you look at dumping, it's the same way as using steroids at the Olympics, right? You're using an unfair advantage to cheat. And so there are ways to, in Olympics, we drug test. In trade, we put in place anti-dumping duties to basically say, well, you're dumping. So you guys put 25% on a subsidy, or you've undersold it for 25%, we're going to whack that back on. And then we're going to equalize it back to where it's supposed to be. And then the World Trade Organization sits over the top of that and enforces those rules. So bringing me back to the beginning, which is that the way that we would do that is we get a competitive industry. We support that with good, I should also say, very good, strong labour laws in agriculture, because that's an area that I'd like to see some improvement from our farmers. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of exploitation that occurs within the agriculture and the horticultural sector, particularly of migrant workers, as the Senator talked about earlier, and it's shocking, actually. But parking that, looking at the macroeconomic argument, we want to see a competitive industry here. We want to make sure that there's a global system of rules in place and that Australian farmers are able to compete. And then if we apply that to every other industry, Australia is very well placed to export all sorts of things. And so the critical piece here is countries not cheating, and there being an umpire to enforce when they do cheat. And if currently we're getting to a stage where countries are cheating and they're also just basically thumbing their nose at the umpire, that is not a game that we can win. And so whether it's rice or anything else, it's a big concern for Australia as a middle power trading nation if we don't have a rule book enforced.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. So I've got another question for Senator Keneally, just from Aidan. So how do you see Labor confronting anxiety over immigration in broader electorates, particularly key seats?
I think you froze a tiny bit on me there, which I'm in Parliament House. We have terrible...
Oh, sorry.
Parliament House has terrible connection, so I hope I'm coming through all right. This is a really good question, because at one level, immigration becomes at times a political touchstone. I would reflect that towards the end of last year, the Scanlon Foundation put out their annual report, which really surveys the electorate across Australia on their attitudes towards a range of issues. And what that, if you go and find it if you're interested, it showed that there is incredibly high support for migration, that, you know, the overwhelmingly Australians celebrate our cultural diversity and multiculturalism and think that it makes Australia a stronger place. What I do think erodes support for migration is when we see that shift away from permanent migration to that two-tiered, you know, society that I spoke about earlier. You know, but I do think we can take some comfort in the fact that Australia is not like our American or Western European cousins, where immigration has become, you know, the what is blamed for a range of other ills or economic challenges. So I think we start off in a positive space. I think we have to advocate for a positive view of migration. We have to articulate how it benefits the country economically and socially, and we have to in some sense appeal to people's sense of pride and nostalgia on who we have who we are and who we were and how we want to define ourselves into the future. I would also, I don't like the notion of thinking about it just in terms of key seats, but I'm not naive to the fact that it plays itself out differently in different communities. But I would point to this. You know, a lot of people might think that, this when we're talking about regional communities, that there might be an instant kind of resistance. In fact, if anything, regional communities very much seem to want migrants and permanent migrants to come and settle there. They help bolster, you know, the population. They create economic opportunity. Misha just mentioned, the exploitation of farm workers. I went to a regional town. I went to Shepparton in Victoria and visited there one of the biggest growers in the country, and they were frustrated because all they can get in terms of labor is, you know, are temporary migrants or undocumented workers that come from labor hire companies. They know the labor hire companies are exploiting them. There's very little they can do about it. And when I said, what can we do to solve this? They kept saying to me, the Albanian solution. And I had no idea what the Albanian solution was, except it turns out under the Fraser government, there was a program to bring Albanians to allow them to come to Shepparton and to work in the orchards, to learn skills, because there were some problems going on in Albania at the time. And if they wanted to, they could settle down and stay. And many of them did. And they spoke glowingly about how these were the best thing that had happened to the town, that many of them stayed, started their own businesses. You know, I think, you know, that Australians understand the benefits of migration. I think where we get into dangerous territory is when we do see an erosion of wages, when we do see a lack of independent labour market testing, when we don't have a robust industrial relations framework, when people when companies are, you know, making a choice, you know, to say, you know, offering a job at wages that they know that an Australian won't work for, or conditions they know won't appeal to an Australian, so they can say, oh, we've done labour market testing and we're going to now go bring in a migrant to do this job. That's when we start to erode away support for multicultural communities and for migrant communities to come be part of us. So I think that's what we have to safeguard.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for that. So we're going to move on to a bit of a fun section now. A lot of people in Young Labour have been following the US...
Oh, I was not told there would be a fun section, so I'm
election,
very excited.
Quite a bit now.
Anything fun about politics?
So just gonna ask Misha. Just have a question from Dylan, just about who Misha would have supported in the Democratic primaries and what he thinks the Democrats need to do to win in 2020.
Right. So, well, it's an interesting question. So, as a faithful New South Wales right winger, I actually was on Team Biden from the beginning. I've got to be honest, though, I thought they were going to sink him as the primary went on and there was a big stack on Biden. I quite liked Pete Buttigieg. I think he was a really interesting and exciting candidate. But I think I think this election is important. Every election is the most important election. But, I mean, I think this election is a critical election in terms of, the future of the United States. But also, it's profoundly important for Australia and the world, right? So in terms of US leadership of so many of these things we've talked about in terms of multilateralism. So I was in favor of Biden. I took a look at Buttigieg, but I think he actually got a bit unlucky too. I think the way Iowa played out, I think was bad luck for him. He didn't get that Iowa bounce in New Hampshire, and then kind of Klobuchar kind of touched him up in that debate, and he didn't. Anyway, so he very nearly could have jagged it, but he's got about 40 years on his side compared to Biden, so I'm sure he can have at least one or two more shots. It was third time the charm, I think, for Joe. So I think Biden is a good candidate. I think I was pleased to see that they went with a moderate candidate and didn't go down the Sanders path or the Elizabeth Warren path, because I think that would have been very jarring, and I actually think it would become a referendum on the Democrats and not being a referendum on Trump, which I think is kind of critical here. We could do an entire conversation on this, but I think what's going to be critical, clearly the Rust Belt states, the question of trade is going to be very important, how managing that issue. When you look at the states that and the regions that swung to Trump, when you actually overlay China's ascension to the World Trade Organization, they call it the China shock, which essentially was the loss of all the manufacturing work in that area, in those areas, and they all became extraordinarily economically distressed. Trump promised, rightly or wrongly, and whether or not you believe he's actually done any of these things, he promised people there that he would stand up for them in their economic interests. And I think it's critical that the Democrats have got a really good answer when it comes to manufacturing policy, industry policy, jobs policies for people in those swing states, in the Rust Belt states, the so-called blue wall that crumbled. I should preface, well, not preface now, but I predicted Hillary Clinton would win, so you can take all that with a grain of salt. And we should perhaps defer to Senator Keneally, who's probably a little closer to home on these matters than I am.
Brendan, I don't know if you
Yeah, well, just same question to Senator Keneally.
All right. In my fantasy football league, I would have gone for Elizabeth Warren, but that's not gonna. I knew that was never gonna win. So I think Mish has really covered it off well there.
Absolutely. So in terms of Australia's immigration strategy, I've got another question. Can you see an Australian government, particularly a Labor government, using immigration as a strategic tool to drive growth while building our domestic labour market? If so, how?
Oh, yeah, look, I think we have seen under particularly this government since Malcolm Turnbull created the Department of Home Affairs, we have seen migration downgraded as a key economic tool. This government, through the creation of the Department of Home Affairs, has securitized migration. It has, it talks about it in terms of the threats of people who might come in. It talks about it through a security lens. And I'm not saying security isn't important. It has always been an important part of migration. The immigration department has always been two sides of one coin, who we let in and who we don't. On the who we let in, it has always been about why we let people in, how we integrate them in, what skills they bring in, how it grows the economy in our community. A lot of that has just been so lost under the creation of the Department of Home Affairs, where you've got a real security lens that, or a security gloss that kind of cuts across the whole department. And you only need to look at the Department of Home Affairs to see the ranked 93rd out of 93rd in terms of morale. A third of the people who work there wish they worked somewhere else. it has had an exodus of people who understood how to use migration as an economic and community building tool. Anthony has created here in the parliament a group of, we've got some working groups that are working on kind of policy as we go towards the next national platform. And you know, we are very much looking at migration through that economic, as an economic tool, because this government has just, you know, the immigration minister doesn't even, you know, sit at the cabinet table. So nobody is really talking about immigration in that context, but yet that is a fundamentally important part of what, why we have a migration program, is to grow the economy. You know, and I think you need to remember that, you know, under Hawke and Keating in particular, we did rely on migration, and we did use it to grow the economy. We did use it to create a sense of successful multiculturalism in our community, and you know, that is there, and Australians are ready for that message, I believe. So I think it can be done, but I think because we bring a real focus on skills training, you know, fixing up the vet system, investing in tertiary education, investing in public education, you know, we had a whole range of policy settings at the last election that I think you will see, you know, similar or same variations of at the next one in terms of the Australian Skills Authority, you know, about labour market testing, about a national labour hire licensing scheme and the like, that I think will help us really promote the opportunities to grow the skills of Australians, and yet argue for the importance of migration to grow the economy and create opportunity.
Thank you very much, Christina. And so I've just got just one final question for Misha. So China allows for flaunting of intellectual property rules in order to allow Chinese industries to have unfairly competitive prices at a global stage. Is it ethical for Australia to buy these products? Should Australia do more to clamp down on this? And what does this say more broadly about China's trade tactics?
Yeah, so I think you sort of went out there a bit there, but I think I understood the thrust of the question about IP theft. I mean, look, I mean, the question of, I mean, technology is kind of critical to economic success, right? And so, you know, every country strives to compete, to outcompete other countries and to essentially have a tech advantage. And then, you know, economic advantage comes from tech, as does military advantage. So, you know, the Chinese Communist Party has made an absolute art form out of IP theft. It was, you know, it was described, I can't remember who said it, but it was essentially described that the intellectual property theft by the Chinese Communist Party is the single greatest transfer of human wealth in human history. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the capacity to make intellectual advances and technological advances and then protect that intellectual property, that's kind of critical to, you know, to the way that we understand how the principles of economics work, you know, and that's how it's worked, and making those rights enforceable, critical to making sure that people spend the time and effort and energy investing into research, investing into innovation, investing into improvement. So again, you know, not to go right into, you know, you can spend a lot of time talking about the various strategies, and you know, for example, if you want to set up a business in China, they make you essentially force transfer your IP across to a joint venture partner. And then over time, once the domestic firm has worked out all your secrets, they sort of ship you off, and that they then deny you market access. So China, when it comes to IP, is extremely ruthless. And every country, I think, should be kind of thinking, you know, about its own system and making sure that it rigorously defends those from incursion and cyber incursion. But going right back to my original comments, the critical piece here for Australia, for everyone, is that we've got a rules-based system. And so be it IP law, be it trade law, et cetera, that, you know, we respect one another's sovereignty, that there's a rule book in place and that there's an umpire. And that when the umpire makes a decision, we respect that decision. And so, you know, IP theft is a huge concern. It's particularly a concern when it's occurring, autocratic regimes stealing tech secrets, military secrets, and then using those to either further enhance its own military or repress its own people. I think that's a further concern to what is already an economic concern.
Oh, thank you. And with that, we'll have to end. But we have one final two questions for both of you. Just as Misha does with all of his podcasts. If you were to choose three historical figures, international relations, who are dead or alive, who you could have at a barbecue?
Are you going to meet first? All right. Well, I have just finished watching Mrs. America on Foxtel, and Gloria Steinem, who I have met and have had lunch with, is from my hometown, Toledo, Ohio. And I did reflect after watching that show that I would love to have dinner with Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, and Bella Abzug. That's just my moment. That's where I'm at the moment. I'm sure if you asked me at some other time, I'd have a whole other list. But they would be a rocking dinner party as a child of the 70s. I would love to do that.
That's a great lineup. And what would your submission be?
Well, I should just point out that this is meant to be the fun section. I'm painstakingly pointing out that this is the world's lamest question in my podcast. So the fact that someone has decided to take me up on this is, anyway, look, give yourself an uppercut, whoever's written that question in. But so for me, funnily enough, I probably haven't spent enough time thinking about this, notwithstanding the fact that I've asked a lot of people. Winston Churchill would be someone that I would have on there. I think particularly, you know, one of the things that troubles me these days is that it doesn't seem to be abundantly clear that the Nazis are the bad guys. So getting the guy that essentially kicked the Nazis' ass back to Stone Age, I think would be a person that I'd definitely love to hear from. And plus, hear a few of his witticisms would be great. Another person would be Bobby Kennedy. I probably spent all the time asking you about JFK, but what I love about Bobby Kennedy, particularly, I don't know if any of you have seen it, but I've just been thinking about him quite a bit with his speech that he gave the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to watch it. It's a very, very, very powerful speech, and I think particularly timely with things that we're seeing at the moment with the protests in the United States and in Australia as well about race relations. And I think, you know, had Bobby not been assassinated in 1968, I think things might have been very different in the United States. So it's I think he'd be a great person to have. And probably lastly, I'm reading a lot of Ernest Hemingway at the moment. So they're all, I don't know how much Bobby Kennedy drinks, but Hemingway and Churchill.
You say this is an alcoholic dinner.
Well, I don't know. He's Irish Catholic, so maybe he does drink as well. So it's definitely, look, yeah, and an Australian Union official. So it's definitely going to be. We need to have a well-stocked bar, but they're my three for the extraordinarily lame, not fun time question.
Well, there you go. Well, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you so much, Senator Keneally and Misha, for coming.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening. I should also say a big thank you to New South Wales Young Labor and a shout out to Brandon Hale for organising this event. Thank you for organising it and inviting myself and Senator Keneally along. I hope those that were there, it was great to see so many young people interested in foreign policy and having so many insightful questions about foreign policy. Also, a big thank you to everyone who's listened, and I hope you got a lot out of it. If you did enjoy it, please jump on, let me know via rating. 5-star rating would be appreciated, but I do read and review all the ratings and reviews that I receive, and I really appreciate the feedback. So thanks again, and see you next time.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.